Welcome to the Yokoji Zen Mountain Center podcast. Every month, we share at least one new talk on the practice of Zen Buddhism at zmc.org/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. If you find these talks to be valuable, please consider supporting Yokoji by donating at zmc.org/donate. We rely on your support to continue sharing this life-changing practice. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Good morning, and afternoon and evening, depending on where you are in the world right now. Today, I wanted to talk about the aspect of emptiness. Just my own experience of this. As a kid, I remember one of the first, what you would call spiritual questions. And I guess I regard it as a spiritual question because it was categorized in that way. When I was a kid, there was a thing called religion that was separate from life. And I remember asking my mom, if God is in all things, how come I don't see him? And basically, that's a column that I kept for most of my life. When I came into contact with Buddhism, I heard about emptiness and the Heart Sutra, which talks about it a lot. Bodhidharma's vast emptiness, which I'm going to talk about somewhat today. The resistance many people get to that aspect of emptiness because it can't be quantified. So many different aspects. So a couple of weeks ago, we did cause and effect, basically. So this is the Buddha's second teaching, emptiness. So off we go. This is the highest meaning of the holy truths, case one of the Blue Cliff Record. I'm getting it from Cleary's book. So, introduction. Seeing smoke beyond a mountain, you know there's fire. Seeing horns beyond a fence, you know there's an ox. Understanding the other three corners when one is brought up, weighing precisely at a glance, is everyday food and drink for Zenis. When one cuts off all streams of thought, one is free to appear in the east and disappear in the west, to rebel or conform, or to go through the world or to rise above it, free to give and take away. But say, at just such a time, whose actions are these? The example, the emperor of southern China asked the great master Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Bodhidharma said, vast emptiness, no holiness. The emperor asked, who is facing me? Bodhidharma replied, I don't know. The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the river into northern China. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Shi, another of his teachers, and asked him about it. Master Shi said, did your master recognize that person? The emperor said, no. Master Shi said he is the embodiment of compassion, transmitting the seal of the enlightened mind. Feeling regretful, the emperor wanted to send an ambassador to invite Bodhidharma back. Master Shi told him, don't say you're going to send somebody to fetch him back. Even if everybody in the country went after him, he still wouldn't return. And the verse, the holy truths are empty. How should one discern the point? Who is in my presence? After all, he says he doesn't know. Henceforth, he crossed the river in the dark. But how could he avoid making brambles grow? Even if everyone in the whole country pursued him, he wouldn't come back. Throughout the ages, he's remembered in vain. Give up remembrance. What end is there to the pure wind circling the earth? Yeah, so it's a, you know, it's a beautiful piece of writing. It's a good story. It shows a certain realization, a certain maturity of a teacher who at that point was probably in his early 80s. So I think many of us watching are not in that in that category, you know, the early 80s. But he's just starting in China, which is kind of interesting at that point. And he's pretty famous. You know, he's also left his country where he was even more famous. And he was like a prince, and then he became a monk, which is highly acceptable in India at the time. And they reckon he could have been from Sri Lanka. So he travels all that way. It's an arduous journey. You know, maybe it took him about a year to go all the way around, past Malaysia, through, you know, past Vietnam and up into southern China there, where he meets the most powerful person in the world at that time. You know, we're talking about fifth century. The, you know, Roman emperors are at that point as numerous as the sands of the Ganges. You know, in the Americas, the Olmecs, etc., may be around at that point, maybe the Maya. You've got the Muslims still haven't arisen in the East. And here you have the most powerful person who happens to be a Buddhist supporter. Imagine how you would be approaching somebody that powerful who could actually give you a lot of support, What would your mindset be? What would you say to them, you know? Also, they could have you killed too. You know, never forget that on the other hand. So this meeting is very open. I mean, the meeting is as open as the number of people on this planet. What would you actually say? How would you do? Would you say things that he liked? Later on, you have National Teacher Chu, you know, maybe, I don't know, 5-6 generations later, he meets another emperor. And the emperor appreciates him that much that he offers to give him a ride to, or actually escort him from the palace to the place where the coaches are. And in that process, he realizes politically that if he allows the emperor to treat him this way and show him such favor, he's as good as dead. So he says, your majesty, don't worry about that kind of thing. I've seen emperors as numerous as the sands of the Ganges vanish in a flash. I've seen nations of the earth appear and disappear. Please show me no, extra attention, you know, in that way. And so then he walks off. These are all sort of what you could say exhibitions of emptiness is, or you could call it non-fixedness. You, on another level, you could call it fullness. In other words, fullness is nothing else is necessary. This world hasn't been written. It doesn't need to be written. It doesn't need to be put in a box. And also in this particular case is that Bodhidharma, as a human being, doesn't need anything from the emperor. You know, for all of the support that he could get, there's also many negatives that could occur. As emperors come and go, their affiliation with various religions and ways, Confucianism, Taoism, and other things, come and go. Then if people have had the upper hand for a while, then quite often they're put down and the new order is put into place. You know, many of us think, well, if we got rid of this government, we'd have a better government. Always remember that statement. I think the WHO said it, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. You know, make sure that whatever changes you put in place are not contingent on a whole bunch of political matters. So Bodhidharma comes in, and the emperor is really pleased to see him because he's just arrived in China. So he's got that novelty, which as human beings we really like. Hey, look at so-and-so on YouTube. Oh, I've seen enough of him. Now, let's try someone else on YouTube. And pretty soon, Buddhism is about externals. It's about what you can attain out there, who teaches you things. Bodhidharma doesn't need anything, you know. He didn't get there immediately and instantly. He spent a lifetime of training. What's a lifetime of training? Seeing the world as it is, not having expectations about the people around you. He just lived that life. Not because he wanted to be a Buddhist, but because that's what he needed to do as a human being. You know, sometimes it astounds me for people as they come and they want verification for me of their practice. But that's not the lineage in the Zen lineage. The lineage is that something is not quite right, or something I need to see is there, and then the work is done. And it's irrelevant about the teacher. It's irrelevant about the people around you. That is the primary thing that needs to be done. It is never the fault of the Sangha or the teacher. If I don't see something, that's my problem. But that's the focus. That's the prime focus of the practice. A place will never do anything for you. A teacher will never do anything for you. But you can awaken yourself. Now, this is why Bodhidharma, when asked by the emperor, who are you? He says, I don't know. This isn't, he's not got Alzheimer's. He's not got dementia. He goes, I don't know. And that is maybe the greatest truth. I wanted to read you something from a lay teacher, Mahasattva Thu, who lived a little bit after Bodhidharma, or possibly about that time. The first of his four criteria about practice is the highest good has an empty heart as its basis, and non-attachment as its source. I mean, again, he's not telling you methods and ways. If you want to, say, teach or continue Buddhist practice, you really have to have that. You may, nowadays, as many people say, become teachers simply because they can teach meditation. You can teach techniques. Techniques can come out your ears. They're endless. But living in itself has no techniques. This is the unknown. It's always spontaneous. This moment in time is spontaneous. These last couple of weeks, I've really been looking at that aspect. I wake up in the morning, and it's like Groundhog Day on one level, like the movie. I do the same thing every day. But the thing is I can't keep it there. I can't. Like, I woke up yesterday, it's a mountain lion. There's a mountain lion outside. Wow. And so, I'm going as well. Do I want to go in the car down there? Or do I want to get my paces in? So I go, I got my paces in, But I was armed, and I went down there. And then, just like, yeah, I'm taking my supplements. I'm doing these various things, But I've never been here before. In this moment in time. And most of the time when it's like Groundhog Day, there's a story that generates that. Bodhidharma says, I don't know. It's the closest thing. He could also say, yeah, I'm Bodhidharma. I'm from Sri Lanka. I've just come around the south. But that's not the closest thing. He's telling him the truth right from the beginning. All of the work to disobey the narrative has been done. He doesn't follow the narrative. This is who I am. This is what I need. This is what I don't need. He's already entered into those spheres of being where it's not in his control. If you go to a training center, it's not in your control. Things arise, you deal with them. there's a schedule which is inexorable. It just keeps on going. It's not in your control. Allow yourself just to respond to circumstances in that way. And then it's not a matter of learning a thing called meditation. It's a matter of seeing through your eyes, hearing through your ears, responding to those things that need to be done. There's nothing missing in this whole world. Now we go back to the to the case, and here you've got Bodhidharma, great teacher, great reputation. I don't know how he got from India, but maybe the people on the boat sort of went, yeah, he's a really good guy, he's rare, etc. And then they called him in. But apparently the emperor, like the majority of patrons, I'm not trying to put patrons down, we survive off that, is that this patron wants to know what kind of reward he's getting for all of the things that he's done. So apparently the emperor had funded 2,000 monasteries. Can you believe? That's a lot. 2,000 monasteries. You can imagine the funding on that. It'd be in the billions nowadays. He's a real fan. he loves this. And then he's also paid for the ordination of 5,000 practitioners. 5,000. And so, I mean, what would you say? Good job. Thank you. I mean, this is incredibly good. What kind of merit have you had? None. Bodhidharma goes, no merit whatsoever. Because where is the real merit? I mean, the temples can be destroyed. Monks can come and go as they do. Practitioners come and go. What is the real merit? That which cannot be taken away. When you realize in your own heart, the awakened mind. I'm not saying the Buddha mind in this, I'm saying the awakened mind, which supports us on a momentary basis. Once you see that, there's nothing that can be given to you. That surpasses the value of this. The one who sees through these eyes, hears through these ears. 24/7, 365 days a year. Has no real story, but the story is a tool that each one of us has. We use that to bond with people. But, it's like with all of us, we tend to follow the narrative rather than what is actually occurring at this moment in time, in whatever way. People say to me, well, you built the center. And I can go, yeah, but I don't look at the center in that way. I look at it as this is what it is now. This is how it is. And I see the potential. I see the difficulties. I see all of those things. But it's just, I realize all of it is a narrative. But the important thing with it is don't follow the narrative. See what you already are. That's the practice. When you sit, just sit. Do it. Same with koan. It's just sit. Do it. See what those koans are talking about in terms of your own life. When Bodhidharma says vast and empty, see that aspect in yourself because it's there. Like for myself, is that when I first started practicing, there was a lot of confusion. There was clouds of confusion and thought covering everything, simply because I've been practicing that kind of thing my whole life. And I was believing all kinds of narratives, my own narratives, my family narratives, my cultural narratives, all those things that were going on. Most of those narratives could be seen through to a certain degree. And it's at that point, then, I began to sit still in the midst of this. It's the only thing that really would work. One of the things I saw within a couple of years was that then the places where that narrative never really reached, where it just couldn't say anything about it. And at first then, the narrative would come back and cover that up. Oh, you can't see that. You can't see that. You can't see that freedom from it. But then I spent a couple of years befriending that. And then thoughts became more like islands that were floating by instead of a vast hurricane of things floating and coming in and going in that respect. And then at some point, there is a loss of oneself in that, where there is no subject, no object, and no vehicle in that process. What the hell does that do for you? It shows you you don't need a followed narrative. Your life is not followed in any kind of story. It cannot be tied down to that. You know, as much as you want to say that you are such a person, it's not true. This is living on a momentary basis. It's got very little to do with that. And the majority of practice is just doing it, just taking care of it, just do it over and over and over. It's not having some intellectual insight and then having to conjure that up so that you are something. It's when these things are embodied and they arise. And then you have some choice in life. You're not just going, press the button, this is the reaction. That's where the freedom comes in. And freedom isn't just to do what you want. It's to stay and focus on something until it's actualized. It's freedom to go when that's necessary too. It's not just on one side. And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of the tradition. That is the tradition, is that realization where the Buddha says, wonder of wonders, I, all beings, the great earth, are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness. You know, that's the standard of Buddhism right there. It's not, I can teach meditation, and therefore I need the badge. You know, I was helping somebody run an MBSR session, and I had people come in, and they'd been practicing for 2 years, and the first thing they said when they came in was, I'm an MBSR teacher. So, I don't go, I'm a Zen master to everyone that comes in. If somebody has a question, I answer it. In fact, it's really, I'm not going to swear today. I really, you know, it's just like this one here who sees through these eyes can answer questions and can ask them. That is life. This one here can take responsibility or abdicate it, depending on the circumstance. The whole basis of Buddhism is the reduction of suffering. Suffering is usually caused by attachment and aversion. We get attached to our own being, our own story, our own narrative. We are averted to difficulty in terms of our own living. Now, if you look at the lineages, that they're not averted to difficulty. They do whatever is there all the way through it. Now, if you think that that's the way to get through it, no. Face up to difficulty like it's the cool wind blowing. That's from Kori Roshi. He would say one of his criteria is be at all times like the cool wind blowing. You know, what does that mean? Is that be like that. You don't need the narrative. Be the practice on a daily basis. You know, again, people ask for certification, is that be it until being a teacher or not, doesn't matter, you're doing it anyway. You're just doing it. And then you can do it simply because you're doing it already. It's the same in any trade. You know, is that people say, well, I understand that. I know business, you know, and they haven't got one. So you do it and then you become a business person. But any person that's in any scheme knows that it is a scheme that is fairly particular. In Zen, Buddhism, what is being promised is the fact that if you enter into something, this is your life. It's not that it only occurs in certain ways, like when I flap my lips or whatever. No, it's occurring whether I'm goofing off watching TV or I'm in the midst of an intense session. This living in itself doesn't cease. This is the focus. This is what we've been given. And people, you know, come to me and they'll say, "Well, why are you doing this stuff like doing, you know, bowing and and doing service. And I can only answer for myself, you know, is that I am extremely, extremely grateful to that guy 2,400 years ago that faced up to himself, understood the human condition, and tried to help people on that very broad basis. So I would do it whether nobody else did it or not. And then the same thing, the second service, for all of those people that have took a position which is innately untenable and unstable, and have continued to do that every generation since the Buddha, down to the present day, whether they be good, bad, indifferent, they made the attempt and they did that. I am extremely grateful for that. I'm grateful for my teacher, you know, and he would say, Americans are crazy. He would say, being from Britain, I agree. But I'm American now, so I am crazy too. But he did it, and all the difficulties that he went through, people criticize him for his alcoholism, you know. I only saw him drunk 5 times in 16 years. You know, that's a story. It's a narrative. The thing that's important for me is no matter what, he showed up. He didn't hide who he was as a human being. Instead of only showing up when it's time to talk, he showed up when he was happy, sad, tired, energetic. It didn't matter. There wasn't a criteria there that hindered his being and wanting those vows for it to be continued for future generations. And where did that come from? Basically, a deep insight into this vast and empty. He didn't need to put his pedigree first or what he'd done from the past. He just went forward and did it. He was very grateful for his teachers. You know, something that had come right through. So anyway, we come back to, you know, Bodhidharma, this vast and empty. It is essential to really see that, to see your life beyond the story that you tell yourself. Not only to see it, but to live that way, you know. Because then that will go into every single action you have. You'll still probably have preferences of what to do. But the important thing with this is empty, like the empty sky, embraces everything. You know? And this emptiness that we are at our basis embraces every action that we have. But then we put values onto all of these different things. Ultimately, these values are our own. They're not others. Others may buy into certain things. But if you want to fully live, is that if you find yourself sitting, do it to the hilt. If you find yourself working, do it to the hilt. Why? Because it's your life. If you live a life half lived, that is what you're practicing. If the things that are beyond the practice, you've already established an outside and an inside on that. You know, we can't avoid but practice as human beings. You know, just look at every person in whatever they do. They practice something. You know, those that want to refine and make it the best that they possibly can, and understand what they have been given in living in itself. And then that is where, you know, the endeavor really comes in. Damn, I've been given this. I can see, hear, taste, touch, smell, think. Why not explore it and see how far that goes? You know, inner, outer, it doesn't matter. There's no boundary in terms of that kind of practice. And you know, you might see is that with Bodhidharma, on one level, he failed. The emperor didn't get it. You know, So what do we do in that thing? You say something, you know, I know not. He doesn't get it. I mean, he could have said something else at that point. Don't think it stops with him or you copy what Bodhidharma said. He could have, you know, he could have said to the emperor, for instance, I'm not saying he should, he can't go back in time. He could have said, well, you know, what is that which is beyond your title and name? That might have really struck him in a very deep level. But also, I think Bodhidharma, this is my narrative, he knew Master Shi, who was the probably a national teacher of that time, and apparently from the bits that we have about him, he was a pretty good master. Master Shi had been trying to, you know, convey Buddhism with the emperor for a long period of time. And it hadn't, you know, the core of it hadn't really come through yet. There's one or two emperors later that really have good insight. So Master Shi is the one who's staying. We should really value this guy too, because he's navigating all the politics of that time. And he's trying to promote Buddhism and get support for it. By the Song Dynasty, that was really in place. It was pretty well integrated. So you're talking about, you know, 10th, 11th century by that point. He had the patience to teach the emperor probably on a daily basis and be at his call. You know, never forget those people that also can work with politics. You know, that takes a hell of a lot of skill to do it. He says to the emperor, you know, he goes, well, the emperor says, who was this guy, you know? And I'm pretty sure he's kind of going, I didn't really like that, what he said, you know, I didn't like it. And Master Shi said, he's the Bodhisattva of compassion, you know. So he's using an archetype to describe Bodhidharma. You know, what's a Bodhisattva of compassion, you know? It's basically is somebody that feels for others and then acts in accord. That's what a Bodhisattva is. Yeah, and definitely Bodhidharma is that. Again, we look at the story, the narrative of Bodhidharma. He might not have existed. There is some evidence, but it's very little. He could also be a compilation of four different masters. You know, but he was the one that defined Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, where he said a direct or intimate teaching. So we feel it, we experience it. It's not coming from the outside, beyond words and phrases. It cannot be contained within words and phrases. Directly pointing at the mind being the whole shebang right now, realizing one's true nature. That process that's ongoing. It's not that it's complete. It's always unfolding in this way. Now remember is that then if you have this awakened mind, then you can encompass things because things are not boxed off. Everything is new on that level. People, our environment, you know, and then to see how they are realizing and opening up on a momentary basis. Bodhidharma didn't go, yeah, I'm the greatest, you know, now. I mean, even the emperor can't touch me or Master Shi. I'm going off. No, he continued to practice. It's not that he taught. He went off to Shaolin, where apparently he introduced Kung Fu, so he was pretty good at multitasking. But he sat facing a wall, or as they say, wall gazing for 9 years. Again, this is where Buddhism gets a bad reputation. He's a lazy bugger. He's just sitting around, you know, looking, facing the wall. No, basically what he's doing is he's putting the story aside and being his environment. Simple as that. Whatever appears is exactly what the practice is. If it's family, this is what it is. If it's appearing in a zendo, this is exactly what it is. And how can I say that with conviction? Is that's my realization. Simple as that. Life does not exist anywhere else but where I am. That needs to be penetrated is right here. It's never in a teaching that is going to come later. If you take care of this, then you can take care of that later. This is an essential doctrine of Zen Buddhism. It's not about the karma or your rewards that you'll get. It's about if you take care of this, you see what needs to be practiced now, then you can more than likely take care of that in later times as they come. It's not a matter of depth or shallow. You do the best that you possibly can with what you have. And then, you know, you share it with people in that respect. Okay, I'll open up. I could talk more about the poems, etc., but let's just take it from there.
You're now able to unmute yourself. If you'd like to use the raise hand function and ask a question. If there are questions in the room, you can just let me know. Ron, you're unmuted.
Hi, Ron.
Hey. thank you, Sanjay Rossi, for your talk today. When you started speaking about narrative, recently I had a very significant narrative of hurt and anger, and I just thought, well, I'm just going to zazen this away. And
I'll remember that. Thank you. I like the term. Yeah.
Yeah. I let go of that narrative probably hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And it's not going. And maybe it's not a matter of technique. Maybe I just need to keep letting go of it.
Allow yourself to experience the anger. It can teach you. I'm not saying act it out, because usually with anger there is an object, and the natural thing is to discharge at that. Whereas if you feel that anger, you feel it as energy. Sometimes you see where it comes from, but that's not as powerful as actually being able to sit there without an object to aim it at. When you do that, is you see that anger can cut through bullshit. And that's its function in terms of living as a human being.
But my anger is generated by the narrative.
Well, then put the narrative on one side. Because quite often is that the narrative is there so you can't experience whatever's going on.
Very effective.
Well, yeah, I mean, try it. You know, I mean, this is something I'm saying try. This is, again, one of the three hidden virtues that we have in tantric Buddhism, including Zen, which is, you know, greed, anger, and ignorance become love, compassion, and wisdom. But this is where the work is in Buddhism. It's not just putting a veneer of peace over the top. It's seeing how we function as human beings and these things that are natural to us as greed, anger, and ignorance, and being in the furnace of that and being changed by those things in a positive way and being able to use them, you know. Because, you know, I mean, people say we shouldn't have these things as human beings. When in human history have we not been greedy, angry, and ignorant? When? There's never been a place. So that is the work. It's not like, well, we shouldn't, and somehow ethereally these things disappear. No, you do the work, you go into them, you see how these things can be used in positive ways. I mean, one of the ways, like with anger, is that it is so vast when you really see it. It's not that I can control that as something else. It's I can sit still in the midst of it, and that occupies the entire space, but it doesn't stay there. Then something else comes in. It's the same with all of our human emotions. They're vast. But we don't recognize that. We want something else that's better.
What is that something else that comes in?
Well, you know, look at your own mind and see where that goes. I mean, I can't say how it is for you. You know, it's like when I get treated better, then. You know, when once I see something else, then. rather than, no, this is what life is. It's always been like this. When am I going to appreciate what is actually going on? That's why Maizumi Roshi, you know, in his title of his book, Appreciate Your Life, came from, is appreciate what is already here. And in that process, then we learn about our own being, and then there is an opportunity to reduce the suffering, simply because those things are not just going off on automatic.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Right, Liam.
Hi there, Oshitohide. Yeah, thank you for that. It was very, very inspiring. You were right on it, as in, just felt very powerful. It brought to mind, the amount of appreciation that I have for my life, and then the amount of appreciation that I don't have, So I'm in the process of learning to appreciate. Could you say, you always say that I have to find out myself, and the teacher doesn't really come in, The Zen tradition is a transmission of one to the other.
Yeah.
So the one to the other is very much part of the process. So by me listening,
that's a narrative.
Intently, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's a very powerful narrative that goes 2,500 years.
Well, the thing is, it's more one of recognition. You practice something, right? Then you find out you're doing it. And in that process is that you realize the teacher hasn't given you anything. That's what you already have been. The only thing that the teacher does is practice that solidity that shows you that you are so. I mean, they may say certain words that you go, wow, that blew my mind, But you're the one who feels it. You're the one who experiences it in that way. It's like, again, I've said this story often, it's that if Maizumi Roshi was going to give me something, I always knew I had to be very aware. There was always a cost in one way or another. Because one of the things that he did as a teaching, for instance, was he would dangle something in front of you, and pretty soon you realize you were chasing it, but it would never actually happen. Or you were given it and the cost would be so much that you would regret it, The thing is that he really wanted me and the people around to be independent and of their own accord. So that confirmation really had to come from oneself first. And that's the first thing, is that when there's realization, is that then there's a recognition that the teacher has that. You meet that teacher as they are, as a human being. It's not like, Buddha meeting Buddha in that way. You could put it that way if you really wanted, but you're awakened. You see that there is nothing else. That's where the meeting is. The chaff is gone. You see directly as it is, just like it says in the verse of the Eightfold Path. See things as they are. That's actualized.
Well, I'm very appreciative of your presence, by you being as attentive to that, which is an example then to me.
Well, it means something to me, and it means it's one of those things I think it's important for people to see too. Whether they realize it or not, it's important to have that seen as well. That's what we practice in places. Otherwise, it wouldn't be seen. It would just be an idea.
But it's incredibly crucial in the Zen,
for
want of a better word, narrative. It's a tradition, a narrative. It's a story, but it's very much a story of teacher.
Yeah.
Being the present, being in the present, being in the present. And then just by being there, sitting against the wall, it doesn't matter what he's doing, but his presence is emanating.
Yes. Now remember, too, is that, you know, something that you'll probably be familiar with is we had a guild system that was passed generation after generation. You know, sometimes overtly, sometimes in secret, that has come down where people valued something and they brought it down over the years, and they found out that they could do it and they started doing it because they loved it. Now, Zen is a broader thing in the sense that I love life, therefore I do this. And I can't escape that. I'm doing it anyway, no matter what I do. So it's more like that guild system. You know, and then when you see the importance of that, then and the standard of that, then you pass that down for future generations. You do the best that you possibly can. Now, in Zen, it's a commitment. Okay, it's not only at first, maybe it's an external commitment to something, but it has to be a commitment to yourself. I am going to do this because I value it and I see that it helps. You know, so really, it's like. It really has to come from yourself on that level. Otherwise, if it's about others and your teacher doing it for you, you never really truly see that value of how it affects yourself and the people around you in that way.
It is very much like the more present I am to myself, the more kind of, there's definitely an element of strength, a bit of happiness rather than misery.
Yeah, yeah, you know, great.
Say,
yeah.
You know, you can make people smile or talk to somebody. Yeah. You ask somebody how they are, they start giving you a story of this and that and whatever. Yeah. And, you know, and then by just lightening it up, you bring them back to a kind of a smiling
and then
disposition.
That's another aspect of that emptiness is the fact that it doesn't have to be down fixed roads.
Yeah.
You know, well, like in the Heart Sutra, where it says, clearly saw the emptiness of the five conditions. Basically, that's how we learn as human beings. We see forms, we have feelings around them, we begin to classify them, we begin to practice them, and then they're embodied. Those are the five skandhas. But the thing is, where it says empty, it means that it's flexible. You can see things, period. No problem. You have feelings around them. Again, no problem. You can classify them. Again, you can classify them in many different ways. No problem. Then they begin to get embodied. That's where the problem begins to begin. In that way, if you classify things too closely. But as human beings, quite often we do that rather than going, okay, I can see things. I don't need to have certain feelings around them. But if I do, then that's just what they are. I can start classifying, but it doesn't mean it has any reality. I can practice these things knowing that just in this specific way, these are helpful. You know? But again, is that with Buddhism, basically it is following those five skandhas, but putting it into a positive way. We can put it into a negative psychological way if we use it in a negative way. It's a very open system in that way, but at least it acknowledges how we learn as human beings. And that's that emptiness, is that it doesn't go down fixed roads. It doesn't need to. But if we're dealing with people, I understand, you know, this is how it is, you know. When really, I really don't know. I have no idea how it's going to turn out. But, you know, just for convenience and maybe helping people, you can go down that road. But it doesn't mean it's fixed.
It's always, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people say...
Spontaneous seems to be the closest thing to emptiness. You're not classifying yourself.
Yeah.
Or you're not classifying the other person.
Now, remember, the biggest part of us is spontaneous. The blood is pumping around on a momentary basis. The skin cells are living and dying on a momentary basis. The majority of us is spontaneous, but then we go, oh, my life's not spontaneous because we're following a narrative. So rather than that, it's just like, just live. Get out of the way. You know, that spontaneity is happening already. You know, the light comes up, we get up, maybe. Or we don't, you know, just... you know, it's just that thing is, oh, I'm not spontaneous enough. And so then you do something that's slightly out of the ordinary every now and then you're being spontaneous. It's a narrative.
Anyway.
You know.
Keep smiling, keep laughing. Thank you very much. Yeah. That
was great. All right. Thank you. Right, Sheila, you're on.
Okay. Thank you. We seem to have moved on so far. Okay. I just wanted to perhaps come back to the anger thing.
Yeah.
Where I was kind of doing stuff, I got to the position it was like being a 2-year-old and I was angry. And that anger was like the anger of a 2-year-old. It had absolutely no boundaries at all.
Yeah.
It was enormous. It destroyed the whole world.
Yeah.
And it didn't. And it was just, it was a really powerful, I shall never forget it. It was a really, really wonderful, powerful experience of just how much I could feel it.
Yeah.
Enormous. So now, you know, when I get angry, I'm just kind of thinking, well, this is throwing me a little anger. And I know perfectly well.
Yeah, again, you don't need to classify it. Just feel it for what it is, because anger isn't a thing, it's a spectrum. It goes everything from mild frustration to the red mist. And so part of it is that this looks like anger, what is it? And then allow yourself to feel it. Mm. And it's that mapping it out rather than going, I'm a human being, I shouldn't feel this. It's no, how does this live in my life? And in the midst of anger, there is a stillness.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, don't look for it, but it's there. That's the vastness in itself. It doesn't need to be turned externally. It doesn't need to be turned internally on yourself either. You can feel it as that. And it's the same with every single emotion. When you see that, no matter how difficult it becomes, you see that as the basis. That doesn't preclude action. A lot of people think that's passive. No, this is the context. Now, how do I deal from here?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, Bruce.
Look at all the emotions and get.
Yeah, but then don't even classify them. See, you know, this looks like. What is it? And then you may feel and experience things that are bringing that in. You may even see some of your habits in that process.
Yeah. And that's exactly sometimes if I'm thinking, what do I feel? Well, I don't know. I can't actually put the words.
It doesn't have to have a description. You can just experience it. And then in time, we're not afraid of ourselves in any of these scenarios of emotion that come in terms of our own being. They're just part of the human existence.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Right, Jonan, you're on. Bruce.
Hello.
Hello.
What you guys were talking about is very helpful. I was Yeah, I just got home and I was having some trouble with neighbors. Mm-hmm. And specifically, you know, someone has their TV against my bedroom wall, and mm-hmm. sometimes it's kind of loud, and then I got a knock on the wall. I don't really like that, but mm-hmm. but yeah, that feeling that I love when I allow myself, I'll sit there and just listen to it and allow that the feeling, I can name it, my anger, or mm-hmm. I can feel like I'm being attacked or whatever. But when I don't put a name to it and I just feel it, then I can, I don't have to be afraid of it. And then when I do act, then, you know, I can, you know, I find my mind going, well, yeah, it's just a little noise. I'm not that bothered. You know, it's not that way. It'll give him another 3 minutes or so.
And you find yourself growling.
I guess not really what I'm trying to say, but yeah, what you're saying actually works, you know. It's like, and it's, there was my other neighbor, and I got to know him.
Yeah.
And I'm there, and I
helps.
Said, and he goes, oh, hi, I'm Adam. And he was slamming doors and shit, and then it's like there's a face to there that now. It's not just in my head.
Yeah.
So it's not this story going on. So there's a face to it now. And that feeling is, because I was thinking to myself, it's like, when have I ever gotten away from these feelings?
Yeah.
Not what I tried, you know, whether it's some kind of substance or whatever, have I ever gotten away from this? No, never.
Yeah.
Ever. So I might as well just, it's kind of, you know, I might as well, you know, do the other way, turn around, and go, hey, you know. Anyway, so that's just, thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate that, you know. It's just like that statement, which is kind of irking, where the great way knows no difficulty. It simply dislikes choosing, you know. And in that sense, is that as soon as you swallow your life whole, this is the way it is. So how do I practice in the midst of it? You know, then things change. It is, you know, again, is that kind of statement doesn't mean I don't like one thing over another. It just means that it doesn't get in the way.
Right. And what I do think to myself is, you know, this is the way, because mm-hmm. yeah, I was in the neighborhood. And it can be quite wonderful, you know. Yeah, yeah. This is the way.
Yeah.
So, it was a great thing, and little by little, it's helping me out.
Good. Yeah, you're like Maizumi Roshi, that's what he'd say, remember? Little by little, or he liked it in Spanish better, poco a poco, he would say.
Yeah, he was saying poco a poco. Yeah, anyway, yeah, right.
Yeah.
I'm watching the Superman show, you know? Mm-hmm. These old movies, you know, they tie people up with like yards of rope. Mm-hmm. And they always tie them arms to a chair or something, and all these people have to do is go around a bit, and then they're free, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's always that way, you know. But the, you know, they never learn when they tie them up; they just tie them up in a better way.
Isn't that what you do to yourself?
These emotions, never, and yet. Somehow, you know.
Yeah.
Keep trying, you know. So, anyway. But, yeah, it's quite a relief to turn around and face.
Yeah.
You know. And not put a label on them and all that stuff and just do it, you know. Like you're saying, that's my life at this moment. So, all right. Mm-hmm. Get rid of this life. It's my life at this moment.
Yeah.
And then I can deal with it. I can knock on the wall without anger, without... Because mm-hmm. then he goes, well, what if they don't stop? Then what am I going to do?
Exactly, yeah.
It's like, what happens if there's an earthquake right now? if I keep thinking about what might happen,
yeah,
I'll never enjoy what.
Yeah.
Right? So, but easy, that's for sure. You know, get out of that.
That's
All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I could listen to you all day, basically. All right. Thanks, Bruce.
Bye. Thanks.